Very warm welcome to the Art in the City lecture series. I'm Tom Trevor, director of Arnolfini. Firstly, I'd like to thank Aldo Rinaldi from Bristol City Council, who's initiated and worked with us on this fantastic lecture series. And I'm really delighted that today we have the internationally renowned artist Suzanne Lacey joining us. Suzanne is probably best known in this country for her seminal work, Mapping the Terrain, this book that was edited back in the late 70s. And in the 90s, goodness me, there's my faux pas, goodness. It's okay, Suzanne will be correcting everything I say now. So in the 70s, over in the West Coast, Suzanne was a colleague of Alan Capro during that really formative period when what we've come to describe as socially engaged practice was really being pioneered. And subsequently, she became very well known for a particular piece called The Crystal Quilt, which in the 80s involved 430 older women in a social practice. And through the 90s, worked on Oakland projects, a fantastic project in Colombo, which I hope she's going to be telling us about. But most recently, she's been over in the UK. She was part of a series up in Scotland called the Working in Public Seminar Series, actually built around Suzanne's practice. And that's how I got to know her. And subsequently, we've been working with Suzanne here in Bristol and with the Knowle West Media Centre in South Bristol, developing a project called the University of Local Knowledge. And that's an ongoing project that's in development at the moment. So that's something we hope we'll talk about later in conversation. But without further ado, please welcome Suzanne Lacey.
Thank you. I'm really pleased to be here. And since Tom gave thanks to Aldo and Knowle West Media Center and Arnolfini, I'd like to just second that. And I'd also like to ask all of the folks from Knowle West Media Center and Knowle West that have come tonight to stand up. My collaborators, stand up. Great. I haven't spoken in Bristol before, and so I'm going to bore you with going back and taking a chance that you have not all seen The Crystal Quilt and showing you that that piece briefly, have you? No? Okay. Unfortunately, I don't have one of the videos I normally use, but I do have a new premiere to show you. All my work includes essential components of community organizing, but to different degrees and purposes, and with varying levels of scale and reach. In Bristol, the work here that we're doing together at Knowle West Media Center is leaning more heavily toward the organizing and less toward the performative end of the aesthetic spectrum. Thus, I will focus a little more on that tonight, but a prefatory comment or two is probably in order to understand how this work has developed, my work since the early 70s, and why it kind of looks so different from, you know, putting fangs in my mouth and being a vampire to floating in pools of guts to working in community. In essence, my trajectory describes a trajectory in art relevant to the present moment and a set of concerns that, with some differences, were very much in evidence when I came into being an artist that are in evidence today. That is, there's a history to our present practices and certainly a personal history to my own current work that might shed understanding of this project in Knowle West, the one we will discuss together, Penny Evans, Tom Trevor, and I, at the end of this presentation. So I'm starting just to show you that just something of the range of my work, two projects in 2008, this one dedicated to Alan Capro in the middle of his retrospective. Artists were invited to rethink one or two or three of his works, Baldessari, Barbara Smith, and Alan Ruppersberg were the other artists. And I worked with architect Michael Rotundi and Peter Kirby to do the impossible, which is to capture experience. Alan's work was very much about lived, ephemeral, hard to categorize, even hard to describe experience on the physical level, the emotional, psychological, and spiritual level, and how that existed in each one of us. So rather than reinterpret one of his works, I took off from one of his works, a project that was perhaps one of his most experiential and ephemeral works that he did, called Trading Dirt. In this project, Alan, who was, yes, a colleague, but later was in the beginning a teacher and very important mentor for me, in this project, Trading Dirt, which he did, I think, in the 90s, he took a bucket of dirt from underneath the house of the Zendo and right underneath the place where Joko Beck, his Zen teacher, sat, calling it heavy-duty Buddha dirt. And he stuck it in a can, a bucket, and he took it around with him. And maybe 6 months later, he decided to go to David and Ellie Anton's, Eleanor Anton, and said, I would like to trade a bucket of my Buddha dirt for your some of your dirt. What would you like to give me? And they said, well, we'll give you special dirt from the grave of our dog. And they did that. They exchanged their dirt and so on. So Alan went about his way over the next couple of years trading dirt that originated in this experience of Buddhism. He introduced me to Buddhism and to that very same Zendo. And paying homage to Alan after his death, I recreated metaphorically that Zendo with the 50 cubic, whatever it was, of hard-packed dirt, the ring of chairs and the circle with light bulbs hanging over, and an audio track of Alan and people talking, a phone booth where you could go and you could call up if you'd ever had an experience of an Alan Kaprow work. And every Saturday we brought in people like Carolee Schneeman and Peter Frank and people who had directly experienced Alan's work. And they sat in that small circle with a small circle of audience, and they relayed not what they thought of Alan, but as best they understood and as it lived in their memory, sometimes for 40 years, what it was like to experience one of his works. They shared that with us. So that piece, I think done in 2008, really does describe the time when I came of age as an artist. And there were many concerns, but I'll tell you four of them that you should keep in mind when you're looking at this work I'm going to show you. The first is conceptual art, the birth of performance. Live art, as you know it here, as a primary practice, happened as I was an art student, grad student, marked by an ongoing question of precisely where the aesthetic rests within the work and what is and is not art, an emphasis on exploration that we now call research. Within the form of work, its materiality and its placement, my work must be seen in the context of this emergent primacy of idea that links it to performance, obviously, in its temporality, and its continuing question relevant in each and every work, where is the art or is this art? Second thing you should keep in mind is the relational and the experiential. There is an aesthetic, again, temporality, goes a long way toward the temporal dimension of art, goes a long way toward situating this notion of relationality in terms of formal issues. There's an aesthetic aspect of every interaction between two or more people. And thus a territory to explore for artists became collaboration and the meanings of audiences and public. Now that was not only a democratic venture, it was a relational venture. It was an attempt to look carefully at the meaning of what occurs in the space between you and me, and how much does that contribute to, or is it in fact, for performance artists, is it in fact even the art, or can it be the art? And of course, Buddhism, Cage and Kaprow, and many of us were influenced by Buddhism. There was the California Gestalt movement, you know, where we all got nude and hopped in the hot tubs. There was there was feminism. All of these sort of pointed the way toward a more transactional and performative strategy in art. Now, the second piece I'm going to show you, and then I'm going to give you the two more points, is the Performing Archive Open Access. Leslie Labowitz and I began to look at our archives from 1970 to 1980. She collaborated with me on many projects of violence against women. And in resurrecting or capturing these archives, we very, very quickly got bored and developed instead a performance. And we called it the Performing Archive. That is, the archive became the performance artist that moved from place to place. And We asked 13 young women artists born during the time of that work to go through those archives and to comment to us on video on what it was that they had seen and what they thought about it. So we were basically opening up our practice to be interpreted through the lens of young women artists operating today. And so against this backdrop, I want to point out the... I'll leave this slide up for you. Two other aspects of 70s art as I came of age. So there was the relational, experiential, and the conceptual. There was also a strong anti-establishment move, both within the culture at large and among artists. I came of age at a time when galleries and museums were not as relevant to an artistic career as they are today, and particularly in places like the Wild West of Los Angeles, where there weren't a lot of them anyway, they were, if not irrelevant, they were only one of a series of venues that we might operate in, and not necessarily the most exciting one. It wasn't that I didn't show in those places and in the nonprofits that were run by artists around Los Angeles and elsewhere. They just weren't, as Tom Trevor puts it, the center of gravity of the work. It wasn't any part of its impetus or manifestation. The institutional critique was what we basically took on when we exhibited in those practices. And then finally, in those places. And then finally, there was a very, as those of you who are old enough to remember and those of you who are bored to death of hearing about it, during the 60s and 70s, there was a very dynamic political crucible from the Situationists and the student movement and the labor movements here in this country, the Situationists in France, and civil rights and farm workers, which I was directly involved in, anti-war protest and feminist protest. All of that was inevitably influential, not only on the subject matter of the art, but the way that we decided to configure our notion of an audience. Mass media, remember the Porta Pack? Of course, that took us directly into intervening in mass media. So now I'm going to, rather than to go back to the 70s, for God's sake, I'm going to just tell you talk about one piece from the 80s, one from the 90s, and then talk a little bit about this decade and some work that might lead us to talk about Noel West Media Center and the project they and the Arnolfini are working on with me. So Crystal Quilt is a project that took 3 years, so I'm going to give it to you in about 4 minutes, 5 minutes. The project was an extensive organizing activity throughout the city of Minneapolis, and in fact the state of Minnesota, and a team of collaborators that created a sort of a central performance. So since the 70s, I've been thinking about performance as sort of the minute you step into town and the minute you leave, or the minute you sort of draw a frame around, this is when the piece begins. And in Minnesota, it began when I moved there in 1985 in order to do this work and to teach. And so for the next 3 years, working with literally hundreds of people and a staff of 20, we developed a performance. But all of the work leading up to it was considered part of the work. And one very important piece of this was to reconfigure the image of older women within the public arena, and to do that largely through media. In the 70s, I observed through a series of projects I was working on how often older women were not seen in public spaces. And so one of the strategies of using a large-scale work is to use media in a way that enhances the political message that you're talking about. And so our strategy was not to use the artwork that was in development and the press's natural inclination to cover the artwork and the artist, to use that as the opportunity to get images of the women that were on our planning committee and so on into the public eye. We had a leadership seminar at the Hubert Humphrey Reflective Leadership Program. We had a variety of kinds of activities that led to this day, and I'm just going to show you a little bit about this day. This is the Crystal Court designed by Philip Johnson, and we situated our performance. And remember, this Mother's Day performance that only lasted an hour which was live broadcast on PBS, was just the centerpiece around this level of activity and relationality and development of a public presence for older women that went on for 3 years. And this is the morning of Mother's Day, May 11th, or May 10th, I guess it was, 1987. And in a moment of calm before the performance would start, the stage has been set. The second row is where the audience of 3,000 will be situated. And the third row up there with the red banners hanging down is the directing station, which would have a live camera, the five-camera shoot director, myself as the performance director, and the stage director sort of operating simultaneously up there. 430 women arrived. 3 days before, people had flown in from all over the country that were everybody from my aunt from Tennessee to the artist from California who made scarves, hand-painted scarves, to go around the necks of the women in the performance. And the performers, we didn't know exactly how many would come, but that performance designed by Miriam Shapiro, Miriam was there, and the two of us were sort of figuring out every possible configuration between 200 people and 500 people so that we could immediately implement it as the counts came in, the design as the counts came in from the door. So with 150 people on the stage preparing for the performers, we weren't really sure, but we had bussed people in, we had put them up in hotels. It was a massive kind of organizational activity, and 430 women arrived. And this is Arthur Strimling from New York, one of the four stage directors, talking to Meridel LeSueur, the poet and writer. Getting ready up on the stage. The women emerged and got ready to enter the quilt, and then they entered the quilt, and I'm sorry I don't have the video that sort of shows you how this unfolds, but the soundtrack for the audience, the 3,000 people, was in the balcony with about 75 speakers. It was a pre-recorded soundtrack of women talking about their experience of being in older bodies, living older lives. Not their memories, the present experience. Again, remember Capro and our focus on experience and relationship. And each time a loud thunderstorm or a cuckoo or a loon cry would go out over the whole space, the women would change their hand positions. So their hand positions changed 4 times within the hour. And this is, interestingly enough, my mother on the left and Avis Foley from San Diego, who had been in a former performance in San Diego. A lot of my work becomes like a relational network where people go from one performance to the next. And now what I'd like to do is just to finish that up with a very quick film clip, a time lapse of the 24 hours over which this piece took place. So this is clearing the commercial scenario, laying out the rug that we had made for the project. And in a minute, you'll see where they discovered it was 1 foot too big. Because everything was measured to the inch, it had to be reconfigured all through the night. Now they're laying out the tables. Every table was cupped in place, so because, as you know, a grid has to be absolutely specific, where now the Minnesota quilters who made that prototype quilt with Miriam Shapiro are laying in quilt tops that they've made that you'll see will be transformed in a minute. And so now Mother's Day and the women are arriving and they're being briefed downstairs, and it's become a sunny day for a minute. You'll be familiar with that. And now we're getting ready, and the women are coming up, and they're on four corners of this. And we've unfolded certain numbers of quilts, of the tabletops. And of course, now watch. Did you see them? They just changed hand positions. They did it again. There, again. And now the audience comes onto the quilt to take their mothers and grandmothers away from Mother's Day. And the Hardy production crew continues, and if I was Christo, I would have sold that bloody carpet. But no. And everything went back to normal. So that's it for the video. Now I'm going to show you four pieces. And each piece has, remember, the community organizing to some degree or another, and more performative or less performative. And I'm going to show you the Code 33 and a two-minute video at the end so you get a sense of the actual confrontation. So in Oakland, California, I worked for 10 years on a series of art projects with a group of artists, activists, teachers, youth, police officers, media makers, and politicians. And our performances were like unscripted youth perspectives offered in scale to an audience of hundreds who would attend, community audience, and then to thousands via various media programs. Generally 50 to 100 people worked on every performance. We began in 91, and it's important to understand that it was coincident with the rise of youth politics in California. Youth poverty had risen dramatically in the previous 20 years, along with defunding of public schools and building of prisons. In Oakland, one out of three young black men between 18 or 24 carried paper, meaning they had somehow been adjudicated within the juvenile or criminal justice system. We researched in California how the pernicious manners that class, race, and age, or youth in this case, were intertwined in public agendas as diverse as welfare reform and immigration regulations, and the role of mass media in that. Between 1998 and 2000, we produced the last of these events, of several events, Code 33, one of the most difficult on youth-police relations. The project, the performance, remember it's not just the event, the performance featured 350 young people in various workshops that we designed, video workshops and so on, a paid youth planning team in operation for a year, multiple articles, television report that again, instead of featuring artists, featured young people, a police youth workshop that we developed as a prototype for training, and the performance. The performance took place on an October evening with 150 youth and 100 police officers on this rooftop. After this, the performance was the third of three rehearsals for them to kind of get to know each other. Everything was highly mediated because we were working with such numbers, and the antagonism between youth and police is sort of the tip of a very, very powerful antagonism that exists between those two constituencies and, in particular, the African-American community in various neighborhoods in Oakland. So everybody is getting ready to go up on the roof. There's the mayor and the Mayor Jerry Brown and the police chief and various council people up there, because this aspect of the work is always important to align them with our youth-serving agendas. So they're up there on that fourth floor, and you're going to see that again. See the fourth floor, and then way up high is where the first part of the performance would take place. And down in the street, we were protested by Free Mumia protesters, and that, with the general scramble of things, caused a bit of concern and chaos for the police officers, who were just not used to being told what to do by anybody, even if it was a well-meaning stage manager. The upstairs on the roof, things were relatively unaffected by what was going on downstairs, although 50% of the audience, a good 1,000 people, was sitting in the street, because the police blocked off the entrance to this based on the protesters, and we canceled Act One, unfortunately, which was the lowrider processional on one hand with the police processional on the other. The lowriders, the police were afraid that the lowriders would get their cars scratched by the protesters, most of them UC students, and that would have really caused a riot. So up on the rooftop, swaths of white, black, and yellow, white, black, and red cars, and between those cars, we stationed 30 groups. In each group was anywhere from 8 to 15 people, police and youth, always more youth than police, and a moderator in every group. So the audience, when they came up, was free to wander and to construct their own meaning, to construct their own narrative, going from place to place, listening to questions that they were asking each other based on questions that they had decided to ask in their preparation workshops. And as the sun set, there were 30 monitors ringing this roof, and on those monitors were videos made by young people talking about safety in their neighborhoods. And you can see the sun going down, and slowly the lights of the cars started shining in on these groups. Sometimes the group stayed hostile to the bitter end, and sometimes they got a little more friendly as the night wore on. And the audience was able, as I said, to move. And there you see the videos sort of strung out. And you could also, of course, see the city and the San Francisco Bay from there. And so suddenly, after the second act, there was sort of up out of the groups jumped teenagers who ripped off their white T-shirts and with their red T-shirts ran downstairs, and the audience was pulled over to the now blank video monitors and downstairs onto the fourth floor, where 40 young people danced a hip-hop flash dance, and 8 down here. Now you could see this, and then you could go down there. This is the 8 platforms that represent people from 8 different communities of Oakland. We had had the youth police confrontation, and now we were taking it down to the community level. And that big X there, that big red X, is the these are people talking in the community. The big X is the mentorship table, so you could sign up to be a mentor there. Projections of Oakland on the wall, and youth media in terms of going on websites, interviewing people and stuff, photography, all that was happening in the community section. And now I'd like to show you just a short 2-minute clip of Code 33, which will give you some sense of this dialogue. And
it happens, but I have never seen it.
It happened in Riverside to a young girl. What are you talking about? That never happened. I get shot down. Now, because you're a cop and because you made a mistake that I was reaching for something, and because you ran my name, and 4 years ago I have something on my record, I got shot, and it's okay. You may not even lose your job. And that's how you're above the law. And you can't, and you have to admit that.
Let me give you an example. A decorated cop, all right? 15 years in the force, kicking ass. The whole 15 years
kicking
he's on.
Kicking ass the whole 15 years.
Meaning he's been making, about. Hey, that's right. That's what I'm talking about. I'm talking about a good cop. I didn't say he was doing anything against him. I'm talking about a good cop. 15 years on the streets, all right? Everybody knows him. Everybody likes him in the department. Citizens like him. He goes out there and makes a mistake like that. What do you think should happen to him? Yeah, that's what I thought.
Yeah.
That's your attitude, though. Hey, that's what I thought. That's what I thought. A good cop like that probably has 10 more years on the streets, he makes one freaking mistake. That's how people are. Screw him, get him out of there.
15 years on the street, kicking ass, whatever, right? He makes one mistake, but we're on the streets, and we make one mistake, and what happens to us?
Make one mistake, meaning what? One mistake about what?
25 to a hell.
I don't understand what you mean.
Like breaking the law.
She's saying if young people break the law, they don't get a second chance.
That's not true. That is not
especially
true.
Not young people, especially not young.
That is not
true at all.
True.
We just got done. We got here late here on a case where a guy just paroled after doing 3 years for murder. He did 3 years for murder. Okay. So there are second chances.
Not sure why that's doing that, but Oscar Grant, this year on January 1st, Oscar Grant, a young African-American man, was shot in the back at point-blank range by an Oakland transit officer, and it was caught on tape. On March 4th, four white or mixed-race police officers were shot dead by 26-year-old parolee Lavelle Mixon. In the aftermath, the fault lines between the police and the community in Oakland became stronger than before. An Oakland CBO named Youth Uprising is now working with the OPD to create Code 33 workshops between East Oakland Youth and all 400 patrol officers. Several of us from Code 33 are advising on that process. So now I want to go on to two projects, and I'll try to show them sort of quasi next to each other, on class in America. Both of these were done by myself with other artists, with a series of students over a couple of years' time in each case. And so I'm going to compare these two Appalachias. The Appalachia of the East, which is eastern Kentucky, the hills of eastern Kentucky where I was working, and the Appalachia of the West, the San Joaquin Valley where I am from. So this is the San Joaquin Valley, and it's a beautiful environment, but one that has been known as one of the worst centers of smog and environmental pollution from farming. There are many other things I could say about it. It's a farming community, but now the water shortage is causing all kinds of problems with people who, with a culture that has basically made farms out of a desert wasteland. On the other hand, it's one of the most fertile regions in the country. It's being developed for housing, overflow housing, at a phenomenal rate with absolutely no regulation to the notion that maybe we're getting rid of our own food process, this food chain. This is now Appalachia. This is Elkhorn City in eastern Kentucky. And it is also a beautiful, deceptively beautiful, right here in Elkhorn City with a river that twists through the road. But this is an area that is devastated by strip mining, by mountaintop removal, which continues, and by natural gas mining in a method developed by, believe it or not, Halliburton, where they go down into the bedrock and explode the rock and therefore release the gas, polluting everything around it. And there is human pollution in the notion of things thrown by the side of the road, things thrown into rivers, sewage dumped directly into rivers, and so on. So in both of these areas, there is environmental devastation. Both of these areas, I don't know why these slides aren't showing up, but that's all right. It says building a common. So in both of these territories, we looked at this notion of a public commons, a main street. This was in Layton, and this main street was captured, and we worked with it right in the middle of the Wall Street meltdown. So everybody was talking about Main Street, Wall Street, and this was Main Street, Layton. A small farming town in the San Joaquin Valley of 900 people. Interestingly, 900 to 1,000. Both of these little towns have 1,000 people. And this is the West version, and this is Appalachia. Now, let me tell you about Layton. So my students went to work there based on, I'm from the San Joaquin Valley, and my project manager was not only from the San Joaquin Valley, but from this town, Consuela Velasco. And we decided some things about the culture. It's one of the poorest regions, as I said, in the country. It's very mixed racially, although people conceive of it as largely white and farming. And it is suffering from, like small towns everywhere in the United States. We invited artists like Raul Vega to come in and portray the local townspeople. We brought 50 students from Otis to work in various courses, and then my students from my graduate public art class began to analyze this small town and decided, based on negotiating with the residents over about a four-month period, to create a one-night event that would depict the city back to itself or the town back to itself. Here is one of my students who is doing town portraits. We did a lot of things, but in in particular, we were going to do this big event. And this is one of the videos that we did. Here's another video of Texas line dancing. The town is very divided between Latino and white, and Spanish-speaking and English-speaking, between wealthy farmers who had been there for a while and new immigrants. And one of our attempts to reinvigorate this commons was to bring students, which would bring their parents, into the mix. And this is a high school workshop. We started a free store in that local church that we used as a studio. And in this free store, we brought objects from Los Angeles. Andrea Bowers and I created an exhibition in Los Angeles. And part of this exhibition was that you had to bring clothes and things for the Leighton show. And so another part of the exhibition was bringing people who would wash the clothes with a wash machine that was in the gallery, and they would iron the clothes, and they would mend the clothes, and you can see them hanging on the racks amongst the artworks. And we took all of those back to Leighton. Back in Leighton, meanwhile, the students were painting the town, and there are some of my students. We were meeting with local merchants to talk to them about, as one of the Latino students, Roberto Del Hoyo, said when he first came to town, is this thing looks pretty beige. And so we began to, I said, well, you're a muralist, let's think of the town as a mural. So we began to work with the merchants to select colors that we would then have to repaint because they wouldn't like them. And this is a part, one of the main blocks of town. Like Appalachia, many boarded up places as well. We advertised our event on 99. We were very pleased with that. We got a lot of news media in, and the town was thrilled. We also worked with every local merchant on that main street in order to, we did videos that would be reinstalled on the night of the performance, and this is an NPR radio program with the Jimmy Gong, the only Asian family in the town. He runs the local merchant store. So on that night of the event, Leighton Live, having been working there and become integrated into the community over the past several months, people came from Los Angeles, which is a 3-hour drive, from Fresno, which is about a 30-minute drive, and from Leighton. And they arrived about sunset. Some of them came to do their own performances, like this cowboy. Inside, there was a gathering, and after that, a video by one of the guest artists, Andrea Bowers. And you can see everybody sort of gathering here to figure out what's going on and to award each other and talk about the town. Here's behind the scenes, my students are getting ready to unveil first the store and then a primary school exhibition, and then outside the performance would begin. We had dragged this to the middle of the street. It was a sign one of my students made for the new Leighton sign because the old one had been ripped off. And it started with a fiddler that can play just about everything, playing bluegrass, Patrick Contreras, from the region. So it basically went from one porch to a library, both the sound and the videos as you move down the street. Outside of some places, we had Dr. Beeler, who was 94. We had an interview with him in front of his closed doctor's shop. We had installations in most of the stores and the post office and so on. We had food concessions and some gratuitous uprisings of booths and things. And then we had music, and I'm sorry we don't have the video for you to hear that, but that was Bobby Joe Neely, a one-man blues band. And then the seven different video interventions projections onto the walls showing the life of people in Leighton. This is the youth encampment, Leighton World, where they made their own sculptural tents to get away to, and they also had their own DJ against that beautiful bus. There's Bobby Joe. We lit the street, literally. We brought in a stage person to set up lights in evocative ways. And then as the sunset, you could see more and more of these videos taking place, and a finale in front of the blaring fire truck with the Patrick Contreras. Now, I contrast that and that event in a small town with this one in Appalachia. This is called Beneath Land and water for Elkhorn City. When we first got there, we had, by the way, zero money. I invited an environmental sculptor and two environmental sculptors, Susan Steinman and Yutaka Kobayashi, and with various groups of students, we went several times, probably 10 times over 5 years, to Appalachia. And the first thing we could do, the only thing we could do, is we figured out how to dig holes in the asphalt to plant pocket parks. And then we went up to a quarry and we got free rocks. There's Yutaka carefully selecting the rocks, and there's Wes being quite disgusted with the finickiness of an artist. And we dropped those onto an unclaimed territory behind the bank where the people we were working with, the Elkhorn City Heritage Council, said, you know, the best way to do it is do it and then ask permission, or in other words, just do it and see what happens. Nobody knew who owned what land. There was no permit process. But as soon as we did this, a year into the project, the mayor immediately called me up to his house and offered to run me out of town, tarred and feathered, which was actually, I had been wanting to get in touch with him. You see those bird boxes, watch them. That was their nature preserve. So we got all the people together and we planted. Now, obviously, the first thing we thought about doing was doing something with mountaintop removal and so on, but we were resoundingly redirected away from either that or some sort of planning, utopian planning process, both of which they had had plenty of, and they really wanted something that would enliven and give a kind of a centrality and a positionality to their town compared to other towns in the region. So here is the first version of Susan Leibowitz-Steinman's natural plant garden. The second time we came back to town, they had gotten everything cleaned up and ready for us. They weed-whacked the natural plant garden, not being able to tell what was a natural plant from something they might consider nice in the garden. And so we went back again, and the third time they weed-whacked it, and then we started putting up these signs and these little blue things. We painted the boxes blue. We had a lot of blue paint. Yutaka poured concrete between his rocks, and we put quotes from people about the river on them. They threw me into the river and said, sink or swim. That's how most of us around here learned. And then we went happily about our way, painting everything blue and sticking kitchen tiles on them, because we had lots of those too. And in fact, Susan, who has quite a good eye and was a ceramicist at one point before she became an environmental artist, designed this sort of massive quilt, come as per usual out of workshops in schools and so on. And then we sort of titled this wall. Now, there's some interesting stories behind that wall. If I have time, I'll tell you. But the blue line, you see it spreading here across. You see how it's becoming blue in various little places. So we connected the town in a way that made a walking trail. And that's my particular favorite touch, the blue bulldog, which I did myself. The trestle bridge, which I'm hoping next year to go back to, 10 years later, and develop a shape notes music for. Lots of murals that don't exactly match my aesthetic, but the people in town love them, and still more groups. These are people from these old photos who are posing, plus my students, and then more Blue Line Trail. So it completed a kind of an arc. And just recently, we made 10,000 town brochures. And on the inside of the town brochure, on the outside is the natural wildlife and things you can do in the area, and on the inside is the Blue Line Trail. And you know, within it, we've contextualized what they consider their tourist agenda. So that is now being distributed throughout Appalachia. Now, I want to finish with the skin of memory, and I will show you a short 2-minute version of that at the end. This is a project in Medellin, Colombia. And I was invited by Pilar Riaño, an anthropologist who I'd worked with before in Vancouver. And she had been doing work, research, and she has written books on youth violence, community violence, and the work of memory workshops to recuperate and to heal to recuperate memory, share memory, and heal violence in this very small territory. So Barrio Antioquia is the region we're working in, and that's Pilar. And right there in the middle, outlined in pink, is the middle of Medellin. One of the oldest barrios in the city is Barrio Antioquia, and or otherwise known as Barrio Trinidad. Now, one thing about that very small 20, 30 block area is that you cannot, everybody cannot walk down every street because it's a highly factionalized, multi-level of violence operating within that particular, with all communities, but it's got its own unique flavor within that community. It's like where I was living in West Oakland. Some people can walk down some streets, but not others. Other people can walk down those streets and so on. And that has to do with the ongoing level of familial and rival gang and known violence. So if your grandkid had knocked off my grandson, you wouldn't walk down the street where I live because something might happen to you. And so we wanted to work, Pilar invited me to work with a series of five CBOs and an educational corporation on work that they were already doing in that community. And we knew we couldn't posit a place that would be safe for all, so we decided to create a moving museum. This is Barrio Antioquia, and this is one of the visual aesthetics that we, the aesthetic elements we worked with. This aluminum is, you know, the wealthier homes, usually ones that are more connected with drugs than others. This is the group of the team, and they were anthropologists and historians and directors of organizations and so on. And this is one of the collectors of the objects, and a team of about 10 people, mostly youth, it developed, went around from house to house collecting an object that held a memory. And then they collected a letter from that person, which revealed perhaps the story, but more a hope for the future, Barrio Antioquia, addressed to an unknown neighbor. So taking the object and the letter, they came back to our sorting area and categorized everything. I think there's 500, between 500 and 700 objects. And then we installed them in this school bus. There's Mario Arricio taking, and we hired local people to create shelves and so on. Pilar and I decided how things would go in the bus and outside the bus. This is a local architect who's drawing maps. Each of these maps is going to show the audience where this is located, this will be on what days. So the bus would roam. It's called La Piel de la Memoria. It's the skin of memory. And Pilar had found that that sharing grief through objects actually brought people together because they could understand the mutuality and empathize with each other's experience. So we prepared this. This is putting finishing touches on. And then we took it out and attached it, sort of hijack fashion, which is done there apparently, to local telephone poles. Inside was, besides the lights, was a soundtrack of the history of Barrio Antioquia. And the first day people began to gather, 200 or 300 saw it the first day, and so on every day for the next 10 days. It finally went out to the city of Medellin, the city center, to represent people in the barrio, which has got a lot of negative associations with it. And here is some of the young people who were object collectors are now converted into the docents of the museum. And the objects were historical, obviously. Now remember, each of these is accompanied by a letter. The letters are anonymous and they're in a big container. And as you go into the museum, you can write your own letter to an anonymous neighbor that talks about your hope for the future of that barrio. There were historical things, there were lots of religious things, there were pop culture things, a lot of things having to do with teenagers, quinceañeros. This one particularly was moving to me because the gold-plated silverware belonged to a woman who was very connected to drug running. This barrio is one of the most known for, you probably know the word mule at this point, but for drug running, for being the people that run drugs to this country. And the most visited, the most prominent shelf way in the back was this one with the teenagers. These are all young people who've been killed. Barrio Antioquia has a very, very high death rate for kids. There was a movie that was done in the 70s called Rodrigo No Futuro, and seven kids from the barrio were in that, starred in it, and they, by the end of the movie, they were dead. The very first day I was there, there was a young man who was killed. And we were most worried that this was going to cause problems. And there was no vandalism. This is Milton, who was a young person. And I'm now going to get ready for the video, which is the final video of this. This will be the longer version. And it's 2.5 minutes. It's not that long. But it's you'll see Pilar Reaño talking. And one of the young girls.
Esa foto es de uno de los compañeros de nosotros. Él empezó el proyecto con nosotros, proyecto del museo, y lo mataron también. Entonces algo, ah, Milton, ah, él era del comité, la gente. Ese objeto ha hecho derramar lágrimas en este bus. Un niño se subió y según me dijeron era el sobrino de él. Él se quedó mirándolo un buen tiempo. Y la gente se quedó mirando el niño al ver que, o sea, los del proyecto nos quedamos asombrados. Hemos logrado tal vez lo que queríamos, que la gente le llegaran los objetos al corazón y se dieran cuenta de que sí.
Milton was the leader of one of the gangs that had signed the peace process. He did lots of problem solving and conflict resolution.
Every time that Milton saw me and saw my backpack, that was a green backpack with Adidas brand name, he would ask me, always ask me for the backpack. So I gave him the backpack and he was extremely excited. Then at that point he said, okay, you give me this, you have to come with me and you have to get something from my home. Mm-hmm. So we went to his house. His family and himself, they were extremely poor. Milton's room will be probably as big as this shelf. And you will go in and pretty much he has the bed and that's it. And he didn't have anything. Like it. So he says, what do you want from here? I said, oh, Milton, give me whatever you want. The only object he had on the wall was a clock made in the shape of the national soccer team. And it was inevitable when I was told that he was killed in Vancouver, I had the clock there and that was like immediately, you know, the whole relationship between object and remembering Milton.
When the object collectors went into the houses, they also asked people to write a letter to an unknown neighbor. And also, as people came into the bus, we asked them to write these letters.
The two things we asked them to comment on was the history of the object, the memory of the object, and the vision or hope for the future, collectively, of the barrio. Because part of the importance of this project for us was to pull that out of people, that experience of their collectivity. And so to ask people to write a letter to an unknown neighbor was to ask them to speak apart from their actual knowledge of people and speak to a collective vision.
These letters were the ones that were distributed the last day of the museum, in which people received the letter with this wish for the future. The mime, someone who might be anonymous. This was the idea how to make the act of delivery of the letter a very special, reverential kind of thing.
Okay, kind of an abrupt stop, but that is the stop. So thank you very much, and I'll invite Tom and Penny up. Do we want a quick break, or do we want to just go straight into this?
I think we should go straight into it.
All right.
Have some time for questions.
And I don't know if you got it, but that basically we were doing a large kind of festival, street festival, to re-deliver those letters that came in, over 500 of them that came in. We re-delivered them to people in the streets. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Great. So we've been asked to have a conversation, but there will be a chance to ask some questions after that. So I think just for a time check, it's 7:15, so we'll be talking for roughly 20 minutes, and then we'll have 10 minutes of questions. So we should be finished by 8:15, just so you know. In a moment, I'll ask Penny to talk a bit about Noel West, but I thought just to start off, it'd be interesting to pick up on a few of those key words that you mentioned at the beginning. You talked about, started off talking about temporality, conceptual performance, and that anxiety, is this art? Which seems to come up again and again with socially engaged practice. You talked about relational work, that kind of community-based social activity, but you interestingly didn't mention the word aesthetics at that point. And obviously, recently, this idea of relational aesthetics has come through Bourdieu, which some people see as a kind of a means of recuperating, if you like, socially engaged practice. You quoted me as talking about centre of gravity and how a lot of your practice has not really kind of centrally been concerned about the art space, but more about relationships, community work. Mm-hmm. And then went on to talk a lot about dialogue. And I think that term dialogue is absolutely central to everything that you do. And indeed, Grant Kestner talks a lot about dialogic, this term, as opposed to, if you like, relational. And it's interesting because, you know, that anxiety about is it art? I mean, we're sitting in this institution which has traditionally been about the monologue of the artist and aesthetics coming out of that individual kind of worldview, if you like. And it seems to me your aesthetic is absolutely about community activity. So that's a difficult place to start, but there's a lot of... but if you like, it's the starting point for a journey to Noel West, if you like.
I think that, first off, you know, what I tried to communicate, and obviously didn't do it all that well, is... At that, in the 70s, it really wasn't about an anxiety. It was not a question developed out of anxiety. It was a question developed out of kind of notions of the avant-garde, really. I mean, it was a logical trajectory of what all kinds of people were doing, from the Situationists to the Fluxus to, you know, you name it, and they were playing with the relationship between art and its institutions, and they were critiquing. There's a very early article of Griselda Pollock about... Van Gogh that I just loved. I would deconstruct it with my students. That was a very early institutional critique from a feminist perspective. So everybody was saying, every artist, I mean, you know, Boyce was saying it. They were saying, we don't like the way actually I shouldn't say that. They didn't even say, we don't like the way it is now. It was the way it is now was of some minimal relevance, and the way it might be was of maximal interest. So when you talk about conceptual art, you suddenly start talking about ideas dematerializing. Performance is, you know, a temporal, it's a movement, it's not just a movement, but it's an engagement, an interaction. You talk about who the audience ought to be, is, should be. If it's a multicultural audience, they're saying, you know, where's all the Latinos in Los Angeles? Where's all the women? Where's, you know, it was a kind of a revolution in... which I suspect comes up periodically in the arts. If you look at the constructivists, which I loved, they're giant, you know, spectacle performances. So I don't see it quite as oppositional. And I think the oppositionality is political. And speaking of Bourdieu, let me not leave an opportunity unminded to say that, I think why Bourdieu is made as much of a hit with relational aesthetics was the word, was the term. Because relational aesthetics captured enough of what everybody was thinking. It was like a giant Rorschach. Everybody just, wow, yes. So I've had students who would so totally, if they really looked at Bourdieu, disagree with him, come rushing up saying, look, I found a book on relational aesthetics. And I think that was a strategic piece of marketing, not unlike that one, Mapping the Terrain, New Genre Public Art. You know, it was an attempt to reposition people's thinking about a particular kind of art. I think So I think that Borio had a wonderful title, and I think his concepts fall somewhat short of the breadth of what exists right now today in multiple practices all over the world. Because he is in fact trying to do, he is trying to rein in those practices and deposit them safely, you know, in the art gallery and in the art framework. And in some places, the argument becomes quite blatantly ridiculous. Like, this work has relationship to the 70s, but it's really not like that art, you know. because it's not taking place in the gallery. I mean, there's sort of like a lot of problems if you deconstruct relational aesthetics. So. But it's a great title.
I mean, we want our projects to be meaningful. And it doesn't absolutely, I totally agree that it's not one or the other, it's not oppositional. But this happens, we happen to have inherited all these models around the monologue here, but actually, a conversation is one of the best ways of really producing meaning. So I don't understand that anxiety, but it's definitely quite current, and it's come back again.
If you think about the anxiety, particularly now, you know, this is a very different environment. It's got similarities to the 70s and those we are looking at, and it's also very different. And the similarities are, you know, America is once again at it, waging absolutely idiotic war. Against unprovoked others, or unprovoked by others. And there's a lot of conservatism, a lot of rebellion against the conservatism, although you don't see it because of our media, unfortunately. So those, there are some deep similarities in the times that we live in. And I think that is calling younger people forward to consider the same kinds of ideas we considered, whether it was it's knowingly or not is kind of irrelevant. I think the times have called for a kind of response. So that's one thing to think about. Now, they're very different in another sense, and that is that I noticed there's a lot of students in the audience. How many of you are students? Raise your hand. Okay, so you're going to be entering an environment, as you probably already know, that is just much more loaded in terms of how you become a successful artist than when I was a young person. My scene was smaller. Even if I traveled all over the world and, you know, got to see Joseph Beuys up close and personal and Marina Abramović and so on, it was a small world, essentially. Your world is bigger, and your world is, in a sense, the ways to success have been captured and constrained within the art market system now. So that you live in an environment where it's very important to get a gallery soon. It's very important to show in museums. It's very important to have things to sell. There's a resurgence of drawing, interestingly enough, among political activists, because you can sell drawings for a lot of money. So that you live in an environment that the art world seems to have, having had it get out of control in the 70s, has managed to incorporate dissent and incorporate engagement. Now, that's not all bad. There are some problems with it, but you'll have to be fairly sophisticated at finding your own strategies to navigate through that, and not to be to have your politics sort of dismembered by the institutions that seem to offer an opportunity for you to make a living. That's a lot.
Okay. It's tough. We should move on to the University of Local Knowledge. All of your projects seem to reveal these the kind of power mechanisms which exist in these different cultural geographies. In Medellin in particular, there's this, it's absolutely palpable, these thresholds. And the projects, not just sort of represented and commented upon, but actually crossed the thresholds. They were genuinely political. Fantastic. So in a sense, that's a beginning of a conversation about how somewhere like Arnolfini, which is perhaps the kind of institution of art, International Centre for Contemporary Art, but sometimes criticised for not being properly embedded in Bristol, could begin a meaningful and useful conversation with somewhere like Norwest Media Centre, which is absolutely, you know, part of the fabric of that part of Bristol, that community. It's been embedded for Well, I should hand over to Penny to talk a bit. I mean, maybe that's a way of starting, just to introduce what Noel West Media Centre is.
Yeah, well, I don't know if anybody has visited Noel West, but it's a household of, it's an estate of 5,500 households. It's also a place that's been done to by regeneration for many years. It was built in the 30s in a time of recession. Noel West Media Centre has been around in some sort of form for the last 15 to 17 years. We've been working on the estate. Caroline Hassan here is the director. And it's an organisation that's a media arts organisation. We work across a lot of different agendas and with a lot of different partners and organisations. We have, people have always found us quite difficult to quantify because we have done education, training, production services, work with artists, so it's very difficult in the early days for people to say, well, what do you do? So we do everything, in a sense. We have a local focus. We work very closely with the community and the issues that come from that community, but we've also got a national and an international sort of presence and remit in a lot of ways. A lot of our work is around socially engaged practice, social media. We work a lot with young people, raising aspirations, challenging perceptions of people within that community. And we've just recently opened a new media centre that was at the time state-of-the-art, environmentally fantastic. It's got 47 straw bale panels. At the time of when we wanted to create this building, there was a lot of opposition. Now we're used as best practice. Everybody loves us. So we've got kind of activism in our blood. We've got a can-do, get-on-with-it attitude, and we want to make change.
Well, Arnolfini and Noel West Media Centre have been in discussion, if you like, I mean, over many years, but I guess the first sort of tangible project that we worked together on was with Helena Newton Harrison about a year and a half ago, which looking at Greenhouse Britain and what would happen with the sea level rise, which actually chimed in with a lot of what you were already doing up there anyway. Currently we're working with Trevor Pitt, who's here there in Noel West as well. But, I mean, in a sense, I feel like I should back off a bit from this conversation because since introducing Suzanne to you guys at Noel West, really, we've kind of stepped back and allowed a project to develop. And out of that incredibly kind of fertile conversation, this idea of a university of local knowledge has emerged, which is such a fantastic kind of conceptual framework. And I'd like to kind of scrutinise that a bit from our perspective. But first of all, if we could talk about what it is.
Do you want to?
I think we'll probably do a double act here. It's a project that has many parts. We're hoping to have a few different partners involved, but it's looking at, in a nutshell, revealing the knowledge of a community that Noel West has and the wisdom inherent in that knowledge, and challenging the perceptions of how that knowledge is valued.
I'm from working class America, and my dad is constantly giving me these little lessons on everything from how to make beef jerky to how to fix a camera. And so I sort of grew up with this notion that people who were working class people did have a lot of kinds of knowledge, and of course they don't have other kinds of knowledge, but there's the kinds that I grew up with I find kind of missing from the academic discourse, which I'm also quite familiar with since I am an academic. And so I've been interested in looking at what is known in Noel West and sort of not known it's known, or let's put it this way, not known by others that it exists. So we're constructing an online university, and that use of the word use of university is quite deliberate to challenge people in that local community to become comfortable with the notion of higher education and themselves within that to one degree or another, metaphoric and actual, because we will be, you know, we will have partnerships with universities. I've done a lot of work on getting working class kids into college, you know, in America and even in Medellin, it turns out. And so it's very important to me that young people in Nol West really understand, because education is one of the ways out of being working class or, you know, poorer than working class. And so our online, we, you know, we're sort of dividing up into kind of categories like biology and, you know, mathematics and so on, and, you know, earth sciences, and we're looking at little texts, we're calling them texts, which are little nuggets of knowledge captured through video, and these are going to be mounted under the description of a course, and the courses, you'll actually be able to go online and look at the course on animal husbandry in Nol West and kind of go through the course through the various texts in the course to understand what actually, what relationship to natural habitat and to animals exists in that region, which is pretty profound. And then we may do some kind of reciprocal events of a more or less spectacular or more or less subtle and insurrectionary manner, which brings people here and people there back and forth. We're thinking about horses and performances and dinners and boot sales and all kinds of different things, but none of we haven't settled on any of that. The core right now is to create and launch within the year the University of Local Knowledge.
So, Penny, maybe if you could talk a little bit about the process, because it has very much come out of this conversation with residents on the estate, and that's absolutely crucial to what the knowledge is. So perhaps to talk about how you're involving people in developing that archive.
Yeah, well, we're doing different types of organizing. We started off and we've built up a body of work over the last 15 years. So we've repurposed about 70 texts already. And some of these are things like how to catch a rabbit, how to poach, how to disappear. There's sort of kind of quite unexpected ones. And so the way in which we're looking at organising with the community is in lots of different ways, actually, Tom. too many to go into, but we're kind of holding tea and cakes. We're getting an artist in to draw what people's ideas are, what stories are. We're working with a lot of the organizations on the estate.
And we're going to have a big section of adolescent psychology. There are naturally evolving areas, partly based on the work that Nol West Media Center has been doing. They've had very active relationship with teenagers in a variety of media classes. So we've got animations, and we've got youth perspective, and we've got this sort of various kind of inroads into different young people and how they think about everything from, you know, gender, sexuality, to, you know, what they're going to do in the future to work, how they work. We'll investigate under, you know, the School of Business and Finance. Mm-hmm. we'll investigate ways people, particularly in this economy, in this era, how people have survival strategies. It was launched in the middle of that community, in the middle of a recession or a depression. Mm-hmm. And we are now visiting it again, you know, within the context of an economically repressive era. Yeah. So we're particularly highlighting this notion of how local knowledge, how working class knowledge in this case, is essential to survival.
And also it's a knowledge that cascades down through generations. So for example, we've got somebody in the audience who is a horse owner and has Tracy here and has a huge amount of knowledge about horses. I don't know if anybody knows, but there's a lot of horses on the estate and there's a heritage there. And so the cascading of knowledge through generations is something very important. And it's also the knowledge that you would get from formal education in Nol West is not necessarily the knowledge that you need when times are hard to put food on the table. So it's looking at that knowledge and how it's perceived and how it's valued and challenging those hierarchies.
And Tom talked about process, and I think Tracy's a good example of we're working together on some of the performative elements relating to horses, but we are collecting a kind of a community advisory group to relook at and rethink how these texts are presented. Maybe they're not going to end up in a school of business and economics. Maybe it'll be a very different kind of school or a different kind of program, because obviously how you capture and display knowledge is part of one's authorship of the whole process.
And also, just to finish, really, we're interested in who the audiences are and who is going to learn from this knowledge. So, for example, there's a lot within the environmental movement, as Carolyn was sort of talking earlier, that people are now looking at that knowledge and going, oh, fantastic, this is... You're putting food on the table, you're getting an organic rabbit and you're cooking it, you're skinning it and you're cooking it. So that might be one of the courses that we do within the ULK, but it's actually what people have done for generations and they know how to do it.
Just a couple of quick things, then we'll open it up. Earlier, Suzanne, you were talking about the performance and you said not just the event. And it's interesting that you've described the potential for bringing a part of the project back down here to Arnolfini, so as a kind of event, quite a theatrical event. But to me, the performance, the project is those kind of relationships, and potentially that's ongoing. So what does it mean to bring it to this art space? Why is that particularly important? Because obviously the kind of the center of gravity is actually in the community.
Well, I think that cultural expression and the way histories are preserved and ways of thinking and understanding and what's important to note. I think cultural institutions colleges and universities, they're all important. This isn't to diss colleges or universities, nor is it to, it's not to set up those oppositionalities. It's just really to look at ways to build a more inclusive and interdisciplinary culture, that we would all live in. So I think the Arnolfini's beautifully sited and has great opportunities for beautiful horses and lights and all those wonderful things that, what did projections on the side of buildings really have to do with Leighton? It was beautiful. It was just gorgeous to walk down that street and see all those projections. So beauty and culture and all of that's obviously essential. I'm dying to know if anybody wants to work with us, because we do welcome. We're at the stage right now where we're really welcoming engagement. We're bitten off a lot, to chew on here, because it's not just a good little art idea. We really intend. The reason I wanted to work with Noel West Media Center was, as soon as I met Carolyn and Penny, I understood the sophistication of their work, because I've done a lot of community work. It is a deep pleasure to work with a sophisticated set of partners. And I, like in Columbia, it was one of the best things I ever did, because I didn't have to be a be-all and do-all. And it's Noel West Media Center has an engagement with the real world to account for. A digital literacy program is going on there right now, and Dylan and I were just talking today about they need real results. They need people online. So this notion of having a university of local knowledge can absolutely not be symbolic. It must be real in order to be an aesthetically and politically successful piece. Aesthetically, it has to be real for it to be aesthetically acceptable to me. Therefore, we need a lot of people to work with us.
So it would be interesting to hear, if you want to be involved, but if there are any questions, we've got about 10 minutes. So anyone want to start off? One over here.
Very clear concept that's there, local knowledge. You can read
question?
With a question or theme that there's some dialogue with the community. So does that work against the kind of funding structure?
The relationship of funding to concept and process is problematic. Because in order to get funding, you've got to announce a date, and you have to do a certain amount of work with the community to even arrive at a concept, and then to have the date means, oops, I got to get going now. And sometimes community process gets sort of problematized by not enough time, because when production takes over, it's got its own rhythm. So those are, and every piece is different, but usually I'm invited by an organization, a person, a place. Usually there's no funding in the beginning. Usually there's a museum or two in the background, but not necessarily the invitee, you know, the invitor. I usually actually partner with them in various ways. So the invitation often comes from community, and or Pilar invited me down, and so that's that.
Okay. There was a question here.
Yes, I'm quite curious about how, after having spent such a long time working in those processes where the community is engaged, obviously you must sort of think about whether you're having some sort of transformative effect on the people that you're working with. So how do you apply from the outcome?
Well, I've written extensively on that, and Mapping the Terrain has a little bit of that, but I do have a book coming out that's a series of essays.
The question was how you measure the transformative effects of your projects. Sorry, I'll try and retranslate
you. Thank you. I would never, first off, call anything transformative that I do. Secondly, because I think that's... I think there are impacts. I think there are effects. Sometimes those are the impacts and effects of a relationship. When I work in Oakland, I've had a lot more impact on probably a few individual young people's lives because I deliberately set out to do that as a way of dealing with the problematics of scale and spectacle. And I have definitely contributed to changing attitudes. I mean, I was invited back to do a training for all the police department. So that I would call an impact. But I've done a lot of writing about this and what should be expected of the arts. And in the end, I think it's a very problematic area, and more so here in England because of the amount of funding you have that goes into art that has impacts or has, you know, what do you call
instrumental.
It? Instrumental art. I think, see, we don't have that kind of funding. Every once in a while, a foundation will get excited and think social justice and, you know, drop some money in that area. But for the most part, it's a hard, idiosyncratic kind of practice to fund. And you have a lot more questions about the instrumentality of work because you're busy hiring creative people to work in mental hospitals. Well, we don't do that. You know, so it's a different question for you than it is for me, and I've gone all over the map with it. I've actually taken measurements. I've had anthropologists analyze my work. You know, there's been a lot of things. I've been working 30 years, and I've asked that question for 30 years, and I don't think that a single project can do what needs to be done socially. I think a single project can help direct energy down the stream that we're all floating down, hopefully.
So do you then expect somebody to kind of take it over, the community, people who are working with? Are you hoping that it will
sometimes not, but I'd like to mention that Roz Hall's in the audience, and Roz, who's one of our colleagues from Knoll West Media Center, spends a lot of time thinking about precisely these kinds of issues, and obviously Carolyn and Penny does as well. And I think there are two issues. One is how you measure it, and the other is what is its longevity, or should it have longevity? And I think if that's enough said on that, we can, unless you want to say something about longevity, after effects.
Well,
After effects.
Well, longevity, you've been there 10 years.
Sustainability.
Sustainability is a kind of a grasping hold of word. And
thank you. Sustainability. Well, obviously, we're working with Suzanne, and we're embedded in the community and what we do. And so the project, ULK, will exist as ULK, the online presence. But then we're hoping that we will do other pieces of work that will come from that. So we'll work with other partners like the BBC, possibly. And also, we don't know. We haven't started the project in a... We've already kind of seeded the project, but we don't know what the outcome is going to be. And that's kind of the exciting thing in a lot of ways.
And I think that if you care about that, and all artists don't, nor should they, I think, but if you care about that, what I've come to is that you have to institutionalize the work. You've got to look at policy and institutional practice as kind of pathways for the work. And you've got to be... That's difficult dance because, one, a lot of artists can't do it. It's just certain people have that capacity and certain people don't. And the other reason it's problematic is that it can kill art real quick. Other questions?
Time for a couple more. There's one here and one over here. Maybe another one after that as well. But
What I'm interested in is the language and the relationship between the art and the language. So I do similar things to you, old 70s artists going on, and call myself a community artist. You call yourself somebody who does relational aesthetics and socially engaged practice. Now, that's academic in the community. If you talk about that, then that's difficult because people don't engage with that language. So how do we put those two things together and sort of make them work together?
So the question is the question is about language and that the difference
in relation to the work and the different academic language and the practical language and how it works, you know, in work.
So what does it mean to be what does it mean to be a community based artist of some long standing, or as opposed to a socially engaged practice? What's the difference in the language?
Yeah, what's the difference?
Yep.
I know exactly what you're talking about. That is loaded with politics. And again, we could talk for an hour about it. You know, part of it is where you point your work, and part of it is the way you will be seen by others at what point in time, because as you know, this notion has changed over time. I would wager that in this country, like in America, to be a community-based artist is lower on the art world hierarchy than to be a relational aesthetic practitioner, right? Yeah. Okay. It's all politics. There is something I want to pull out of what you said, and that is that when you're in a community, you talk the language of the community, and I think good public practice functions on multiple levels. That I can sit down and talk to my dad, who's a repair mechanic, and I can talk to Alan Capro, and by the way, they can talk to each other. And you know, how you choose to communicate to people is based on how and what they understand and how you empathize with them. Mm-hmm. Now, the political issue, I don't think I even want to touch right now. It's big, and I think it's completely current in what's happening in this country in particular.
Okay, one more question here.
You talked about impact and social change, and it seems to be changing emotions and changing the understanding of people involved. I might have missed it in some things you said earlier, but how has your practice changed you over your career? How has your understanding of yourself changed?
Oh, that's such a good question, because I enter every project with a question.
So, Suzanne, we've got to tell them the question. It's the impact on Suzanne as an artist or as a subject.
I wouldn't necessarily bracket as an artist. I'm just using the
impact.
Yeah, as an individual, in contrast to the impact on community, on social space, if you like.
I didn't get the contrast even there. I just got, how does it impact me?
Yeah.
Well, it is my life. And I live my life and my relationships pretty exclusively at this point through my work. And I've occasionally had a few people that were kind of like on the outside of my work, but not so often. Even my family, I incorporate into my work. They're in performances. I make art out of them, with them, about them. And I write about them, you know. So, and this whole exploration of class is, and the San Joaquin Valley, which is, you know, butt ugly, as we would say, environment, is my home, which I return to make art out of. So I've been only, everything I know, I almost know since I've been 25 or so, I know through my work. So it's changed me profoundly.
Someone was asking for a quick last question here. If could I
just... Yeah, just going back to the previous thing we were talking about with speaking the language of the community, and also earlier you mentioned that usually you have an invitation from the community. And I just wondered if you could talk a little bit about the instance in which you might come in as not somebody from that community, maybe as a very much an outsider, like going to Colombia, for example, how you learn to speak the language of that community, and also how it might be different in a situation without an invitation.
So the question is how to deal with coming in from the outside and the different kind of ways of accessing in, whether it's through invitation or not. So,
have I done that at Norwest? Have I?
Have you done that? Well,
have I?
Suzanne has done it, yeah.
How?
Well, what she does is she listens and doesn't... put forward her opinion, and she respects other people and what they do and what they say. And there was a question earlier, I can't quite remember what the question was, but what Suzanne does very eloquently is allow people to feel very valued within themselves and about what they're saying. And I think that's one of the most important things that you can offer if you go into a community to work with a community, is to listen and be respectful.
And I get everybody to talk for me.
And of course, she does talk very loud sometimes.
Okay, well, we should wrap it up. It is a project that's in development, and the conversation is the kind of ground that it's growing out of, so it's important that we keep the conversation going. So I think very much that invitation to get involved with the conversation is
yeah.
going out. And you talked early on about the in the 70s, that sort of conversation with the art institution, and it's a good conversation for us to be a part of as
yeah.
well now
yeah.
definitely. So and perhaps the conversation needs to happen with academia as well, because you know, after all, we have these hierarchies of value of knowledge, and what this is a real challenge to is some knowledge being worth more than others.
Are there any teachers, faculty here? Raise your hand.
Okay.
Great. And, we got a lot of students, too, so good. We could have some rolling seminars, you know. We could have conversations mm-hmm. over the next year or so about this. It would be really fun.
So it's just begun.
Okay,
great.
So thank you very much indeed. Thank you, Suzanne.
Lock him at the door.
Thanks.
Did you want to play?